Gauge grandeur or define divinity? Can you evaluate the essence of excellence? Is majesty merely a measure of might, power, prestige, or popularity? Can splendor simply be summed up by social status? Or might there be something more creative than the canned conclusion our culture has come to? Who could demonstrate a life defining true greatness? Who might elevate above the awe of angels, look beyond the limits of the law, and transcend the truth of Torah? Who might move beyond the miracles of Moses and precede the prized promised land? Who might surpass the position of the priests modeling the immorality of Melchizedek? Whose sacrifice could solidify sustaining sanctification? Whose covenant could fully capture the criteria of perfection? Who can transmit transformation through trust, fabricate faithfulness, and bring life that multiplies life from dust? This is the Book of Hebrews.
Hey, everyone. Happy Sunday. You guys are here, not watching the first 2 hours of the Oscars. Thanks for coming and hanging out. It's like 4 hours now, so there's time, right? All right. Well, tonight we journey back into the letter to the Hebrews. We have these, by the way. These are our scripture journals. It has the entirety of the letter to the Hebrews with note space on the side. And we have some extras at the back that you can, if you don't have one yet, you can take on your way out as our gift to you. And if we run out, come back next week and we'll get a restock, okay? We've been out of the letter to the Hebrews for the last 3 weeks while we have been in a church value series. And so I'm really excited to journey back in. And specifically tonight, we're going to be hanging out in Hebrews chapter 2, starting in verse 10. So if you want to go ahead and flip your Bibles there, you're more than welcome to do exactly that. Now, while you're flipping there, I was thinking this week about the relationships between siblings, and specifically one relationship in particular. I know it's like the week of St. Patrick's Day, but I'm going back to Christmas for a second with Elf. And so in Elf, you have Buddy and his brother, Michael, and there's a tragic scene that I think the music just makes you feel a different way about, okay? So hang out with me on this, all right? So the scene is Buddy, brand new to the city of New York, a city that is dark and cold and wet. And he stands outside for his brother outside of his school. And he's there, excited to go and play. And so when all of a sudden Michael comes out of school, he is so excited. He's waving up and down. And he goes, like, keeps going up and down. And Michael looks at him and then just starts walking away as fast as he can. Don't you think the music should be like much more sad and dark for a moment like that? Like, he has been clearly, he's like ashamed of his brother. That's hard. But the music is whimsical, so you don't feel so bad about it. But I digress. Buddy is blissfully unaware of the shame being directed his way. And he keeps pursuing after his brother. For most of us, we know what it feels like when somebody is ashamed of us, right? Maybe it's in the present. Maybe it was just a moment in your past. Maybe it's when you were a child. There's like a moment that crystallizes when you felt ashamed of. That look from a significant other or an ex or a parent or a friend or your boss, and you have all the information just written on their face. Do you ever feel like God's ashamed of you? Do you ever feel like he sees you and he looks at you with like a face of disgust? Do you ever feel like your existence, your past, your sufferings, your fill in the blank is all just too messed up for him to handle? These are the questions regarding shame that we're going to walk into tonight as we jump back into the letter to the Hebrews. And so we're in Hebrews chapter 2, verse 10. Now, a little bit of backstory, just in case, because it's been a few weeks and since we've been in this letter, or maybe you're new to us and you haven't journeyed with us in this letter so far. But the letter of the Hebrews is a letter written by an author unknown to the Jewish followers of Jesus who are living most likely in the city of Rome, which is the capital of the known world. And these Jewish followers of Jesus have experienced great pressure bordering into persecution on all sides. As followers of Jesus, the Roman authorities are not looking kindly on this new sect of Judaism. And so the rumors are beginning to spread that that businesses are being closed, families are being harassed, people are being carted off. The difficulty and the fear is starting to spread. It's palpable. But also because they're Jewish, that means that their family of origins would have disowned them for beginning to believe that this itinerant rabbi, Jesus, is indeed the Messiah. That this rabbi who was hung up on a Roman cross was extended the most humiliating of deaths to believe that he could be Messiah. Man, in your typical Jewish household, you would want nothing to do with that family member until they repented and made their way back in. And so this letter, as we've discovered so far in it, and you can go back to the podcast if you want to get caught up with us, but it has been so far about that pressure, that feeling of the world is caving in on me. Would it be better for me to just go back? To just like leave this Jesus business behind me? It was that weird phase that I went through. And instead, like I'm just gonna go back. And so into this, we continue tonight. Hebrews chapter 2, verse 10. For it was fitting. For it was fitting. Okay, let's pause there for a sec. For it was fitting. Now, this phrase unlocks the rest of the passage that we're about to read about. So it's important that we get this phrase down cold right now. When something is fitting, it means that something is of the right size, the right amount, the right timing for whatever the task is at hand. Think specifically of a lock and a key. We're going to keep going back this tonight. Think of a lock and a key. Have you ever gotten to your house and assuming you don't have a touchpad, you go up and then you're sure that the key that you're using is the right one. And so you keep forcing it and believing that it's the lock has changed magically overnight. And so you're like working it and you're like getting frustrated just to realize that it was the key right next to it. And so then you take that one out. You're like, okay, yeah, that's the right one. All right. So that the right key is fitting for the lock. The right key is fitting for the lock. And so when it's saying fitting, the way I was phrasing this in my mind is something to the effect of like a key to the proper lock. It was an exact fit that he, okay, who's the he that he's talking about in this passage? It was fitting that he, for whom and by whom all things exist. So this is like your standard pat Sunday school answer to the question, who is the he? It's Jesus. It's God, okay? So it's the triune God of the universe in whom it is fitting and bringing many sons to glory. So let's go back to our lock and our key. This is the lock. This is the aim. This is the desire of God. To bring many sons to glory. Now, when it mentions sons, what I don't want you to think is male prodigy, progeny. Anyway, okay, the male children of a parent. Instead, what it is saying is it's referencing to sonship. Sonship. That is an ancient Roman custom that is the full rights and authority and inheritance and position and relationship that is had between a father and in this patriarchal culture, their male sons in the elite Roman households. So to have sonship, to be given the rights of sonship, is to get the ultimate act of belonging, of worthiness of the family name. It means that you have a future and a hope because you are inheritors of some vast inheritance. And so the language that's used here don't have so much in mind male inheritors, but the idea of heirs, sons and daughters of the king. And so to continue my paraphrase, like a key fitting into a lock, it was an exact fit that God would bring many of his heirs to glory. Now to be brought to glory is to be brought to a state of absolute joy, abundance, life, flourishing, freedom. It's a full knownness by the Father matched by a full loveliness of his presence. So that's God's aim for our life. This is the lock. But what's the key? What could so perfectly fit into that lock to unlock it and make all of that wonder become a reality? Well, it continues. Bringing many sons to glory should make the founder of their salvation perfect through suffering. And so here is our perfect fit. Here is our key. The lock, bringing many heirs to glory, would be unlocked by the perfect key, the founder of our faith, suffering. So the idea of Jesus suffering, even if this is your first time ever suffering in your church, that probably doesn't come as like an, oh, I'm shocked that that's what Jesus did, that he suffered and died on a cross. Like that is fairly common knowledge at this point. Like it's not a great spoiler, at least in the West. And it's so easy then for that to become an obvious statement. That like, yeah, of course, Jesus dies on the cross every time that story occurs, right? And we'd be right, but we'd be mistaken to do anything other than stand in awe of this statement. Because what we are tempted to do so easily, definitely me, is we are able to allow the extraordinary realities of the gospel to become ordinary because of exposure. Like when you have the most delicious food on like a cruise and you're like have it day after day after day after day. And then at the end, you're like, I mean, it's like, okay. But like at the beginning, you're like, this is the best stuff ever. It's so easy that when you have it, something repeated over and over and over again, it makes sense that it would kind of lose its luster, that it loses its wonder. And yet, this is the singular truth that your heart was created to crave for. And although it is so easy for us to go, yeah, Jesus suffered, we have to protect our heart and reshape in our heart over and over and over again to see this with absolute wonder. Now, we're going to keep going with that thought in a moment, but let's go ahead and go back to why did he have to suffer in the first place? I'm sure you have asked this question at some point if you've ever really given Jesus much of a thought. Specifically, what does it mean that this founder of salvation, meaning Jesus, is made perfect through suffering? The phrase here for the founder or the, in other translations, I like this word, the pioneer of salvation. This is a role that Jesus came to fulfill. So it was a task at hand, and there was a role that came with that task sheet, and so he took that on. Now, the Greek word here, though, for the word perfect has a root word in Greek, teleo. Teleo literally means to perfectly complete a task or a mission, to perfectly complete a task or a mission. And so when we read this at surface level, it sounds odd. Should make the founder of their salvation perfect through suffering, as if somehow Jesus wasn't perfect and now he was made perfect because he suffered. But what it's getting at is it's not that he was made perfect, it's that his role was fulfilled in perfection. So rather than a confusing concept, what the author is trying to write down is an incredible one. He has already founded salvation. He has already pioneered the journey toward salvation. It is now a fixed anchor point reality that any that would come can latch onto. In fact, this is directly tied into Jesus' last words that he uttered on the cross. As he hangs on the cross, John would record this in John 19, verse 30. Jesus draws in his last breath and he utters, "Tetelestai, it is finished," with the same Greek root word, teleo. What was finished? Jesus' life? Is he like throwing in the towel? No, he's going to raise again in just a few days. He knows what's coming next, but what he is saying is the task that I have been sent here, the aim, the thing that I was called to found and pioneer, it is finished. The aim has been completed. The mission's not over, but this aim has been completed. In that moment, the key had been turned through the suffering of Jesus to undo the lock. Again, I like that word pioneer. I think it's because I grew up in California, and oftentimes in school lessons growing up, you would learn about the pioneers who settled California, that for Europeans, they would make their way across the continental United States with California in mind as a major destination point. And these pioneers, when they would come to settle, they were trailblazers who put themselves through a lot of suffering and heartache to expand into to expand the colonies and to create a hopefully better life for themselves. So they cleared a path through hard winters, through difficult terrains, and because they cleared the path, then it allowed other wagons and eventually railroads and eventually highways for cars to travel those same paths. So to be a trailblazer, to be a pioneer, to be a founder is to begin the work that allows others to then follow in the wake. Now, in a pluralistic society like ours, that means a culture and a society filled with a vast amount of beliefs and with a desire to say, well, aren't we all just kind of saying exactly the same thing? So in a world, in a culture like us, any truth claims that seem exclusive seem passé. Hence, Jesus seems out of step oftentimes when you look at any of his objective truth claims. Like, nobody can come to the Father except through me. But you see, Jesus didn't come to close off all of the other options. Like, before Jesus, everyone had open range to heaven. And then Jesus came, and then all of a sudden, what he was actually doing on the cross was he was shutting all of the doors for everyone else. And he's like, I'm just going to make it so hard only through me because I'm kind of like that. That's not Jesus at all, right? No, what Jesus did is he is a pioneer. He is a way maker. And what he did on the cross, what he finished on the cross, was he created a pathway where there was no pathway. He created a space and a way back to glory. And so it was perfectly fitting in God's mind that the cost to bring his heirs back into his family would cost him the suffering of his own son. Now, I wouldn't think that was perfectly fitting. I would be thinking of an easier way than that. Anything easier. But no, God knew that the only way to forge this path would have to happen as deity took on humanity. And in humanity, he suffered to bring us along with him back to the divine. And so with this, we continue in verse 11. For he who sanctifies and those who are sanctified all have one source. So let's go to that part. Those who are sanctified, finished. It is finished. It's that same language. Talios, the aim has been perfectly matched. The mission has been accomplished. In other words, Jesus makes these heirs holy. Now, not in the progressive sense we often talk about here at Mosaic, the importance of ongoing sanctification. We're talking about progressive sanctification. We often use phrases like becoming more like Jesus in body, mind, and spirit. Now, there's a reality that is progressive sanctification, that is the life of a follower of Jesus from the time that they begin to follow after Jesus until the time that they draw their last breath. But there is another type of sanctification. It is a solidified at one moment sanctification. It's a solidified reality that we belong to him and he to us. And here is what is so incredible. This has happened because we have a singular source. So let me read that passage one more time. For he who sanctifies and those who are sanctified all have one source. Now, it's important to note the scriptures in no way ever undersell the importance of this level of family belonging, that we have been adopted into the forever family of God. See, what makes a son or a daughter, you receive that title in relation to having a mother or a father. And so for me, Asher is my son. He was adopted into our family in 2020. He is my son regardless of what he does. Yes, we're seeing that, right? Okay, yeah. He is my son no matter what he does. And I am his dad regardless of whatever could happen to me. Now I have a daughter. Her name's Abigail. And so Abby is my daughter. She was born into our family in 2020. Yeah, same year. It was a lot. It's okay. They're so easy now. She is my daughter regardless of what she does, though. And I am her dad regardless of what could ever happen to me. Those things are factual sentiments. Now, Abby and Asher, if they are both my children, then what does that make them? Siblings, brothers and sisters, right? Not Jesus. That would have been that. Abby and Asher are siblings because they share the same source. Having Allie and I as their parents made Abby and Asher forever interconnected as siblings. They will always be able to call each other brother and sister, although I'm pretty sure there are definitely times already and definitely times in the future where they won't want to, right? They are united together through us. Even if I were to die one day, they are still siblings. They are still brother and sister. Nothing that they have ever done, nothing that could be done to me could ever earn that reality or negate that reality. And so when Jesus calls us brothers and sisters, he is referencing to our belonging to the same source, our Father. And so we continue. For he who sanctifies us, those who are sanctified, all have one source. They're all united together. And that is why he is not ashamed to call them brothers. He's not ashamed to call us brothers. He is not ashamed to look at us on our best days and on our worst days and say, you are mine and I am yours. We are interconnected because we share now in the same source. Do you ever think, though, that you're like Buddy, waiting outside for Jesus, hoping that he waves back? Do you ever feel like God, he puts up with you? That you have come to the point of accepting that God loves you? Because that kind of feels like a have to. But like he likes you, he wants to hang out with you. That, are you afraid of his reaction? Jesus told a story of two brothers, the one who left and the one who stayed. Now, the brother who left was younger. He was ashamed of his father and he refused to live his life according to the ways of the family. So he wanted to live apart from expectations, apart from his father's desires, apart from the life that his father had provided for him. So he flees and he takes his inheritance liquidated with him. Now the one who was older stayed, and he worked hard, and he took pride in his efforts. Now we might think naturally that the older brother made the right call because he didn't abandon his father. He didn't leave home. But by not leaving home, he was abandoning his younger brother by not going after him. The younger brother goes off to a far-off land, and as he goes off to a far-off land, he cashes in the inheritance and squanders it all on reckless living, defining what the good life is for himself. But a great famine hits the land, and he ends up sleeping in a barn, hungry, broke, and broken. And so broken, he decided to go home and to beg his father not to be received back as a son. He knew that there was no way that that was going to happen. But if he was just the most generous man on the face of the earth, which he believed he was, then he might just be received back as a servant. He knows he disqualifies himself from love, but maybe pity. Maybe he could get pity back. He had shamed his father, and so his best hope was an employee status. And as he draws closer and closer, going from the far off land up back to the near land, he sees a figure in the distance sprinting towards him. And it's his father, who cannot wait until his son gets home. But he runs out to him, calling for him. The son who was dead is now alive. The one who was lost is now found. And this moment warrants a feast of epic proportions like no one had experienced before. But where's his older brother? Once again, he isn't in sight. Once again, he has abandoned his younger brother every day. And now, once again, that his brother is home and he is nowhere to be found, he is ashamed. He is ashamed. And we see that in the tone of his language, telling the father, "Your son left. Your son abandoned us. And you throw him a party?" No. In other words, "Dad, I'm ashamed of him. And it makes no sense why you wouldn't be as well." See, the younger brother knew that he deserved to be ashamed of. His actions dictated that. And the older brother simply agreed. "You deserve to be ashamed of, and I'm going to heap it on you." Now, for many of us, this is oftentimes how we think of Jesus' posture towards us. Your story is too messy. You might believe that Jesus came to save you, but you can't comprehend that he would be happy to tell others that you're his sibling. But see, Jesus is the true and better older brother. He didn't wait for us to try to return. He went and pursued his siblings, finding us in the pit, broke and broken. And he says, "You are my sister. You are my brother. Let's get you up. We're going back home." Now, for some of us, we hear this, and it's not so much that, and you can't even comprehend the idea that Jesus would ever, that you've ever done anything to be worthy of being ashamed over. Like, this doesn't really click. I don't feel like that's me. There's no reason that he would have ever been ashamed of me in the first place. So this verse doesn't really seem to hit home with me. Can we keep going? But see, whether you don't know what you think about Jesus or you've been journeying with Jesus for decades, don't be too quick to move past this reality. One time in Mark chapter 2, Jesus recorded in his teaching saying this, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I came not to call the righteous, but sinners." Those who are well have no need of a physician. Assumingly, they didn't have preventative medicine back then. And so you would need a physician when you're sick, and specifically when you know you're sick. When you know you're sick. And so what Jesus says, "I came not to call the righteous, but sinners." Now, when he says, "I came not to call the righteous," he's playing around with the reality at the time. He is saying, "You think you're righteous. I mean, Jesus can read every person like nobody's business. He knows that there is no person who's actually righteous before God. He knows that there's no one who actually has their act figured out on their own terms. But he is saying, you don't call yourself a sinner. And because of that, there's not much I can do for you. It's not that he doesn't want to. It's that you're not allowing space in the relationship to come to him in desperation, in need. If the younger brother would have thought of himself as like, I'm living in this pigsty. I'm the boss of this pigsty. Like, I am rocking it up in here. Wait till I fix this. I'm turning all this around. I am the best. There's not much that could have been done for him then. But because he looks at himself and he has this awakening moment of grace that like, oh my gosh, this is awful. Because he realizes that he is ready to finally come to the Father. See, in our culture, the perspective on both the political right and the left is this deep-seated belief that the fix for the human psyche is to think well of yourself, to simply esteem yourself better, to beam with self-pride, see yourself as a star and shine bright. But Jesus didn't come for those who believe they're healthy on their own, those who believe that they are already pretty good and they only need like a 2% Jesus tune-up. He came for those who understand that they don't even know how sick they are yet. I had a family member who a few years ago began complaining of abdominal pains. And this family member refused to see a doctor for well over a year. And it got worse and worse and worse. And he was terrified of hearing bad news. So he kept telling himself and everyone else, it's not a big deal. And what was likely a treatable form of cancer had spread severely by the time he finally decided to seek help. The news that healing is available is only good news to someone who first understands the bad news of their condition. If the younger brother never realized the depths of his deep need, if he saw himself as the king of the world rather than as a ruined man, I love this phrase that grace only sticks to our imperfections. But I'll change up just a little bit. Grace only sticks to the imperfections, to the brokenness that you are willing to surrender and be vulnerable with before God. But the true older brother, Jesus, came and changes everything. He pursues after his brothers and sisters who deserve shame as sinful humans that we all are. But what we receive from him is not, I told you so's, it is unmerited grace. It's unmerited grace that he had been lowered to the human condition and so shares with us in our humanity. And he has in turn elevated us into a relationship with God as our Father. See, Jesus in every way is the good and true older brother who came to redeem and restore us from the darkness, from the bondage, not filled with shame on us, not looking for us to give a 10% cut back to him, but with his gaze ecstatic because his brothers, his sisters who were lost have now been found, who were dead are now living. And this is beautiful. And I love how the author is now going to take this in our final couple passages. Verse 12. He's going to use three Old Testament quotes to give language to Jesus' heart for his adopted siblings. Now, verse 12 is going to come from Psalm 22. Now, this is the same psalm that Jesus would riff off when he was hanging on the cross and he said, my God, why have you forsaken me? So let's look at the focus on this quote. And I will tell of your name to my brothers. In the midst of the congregation, I will sing your praise. So this psalm focuses on the suffering of Messiah, as well as the reality that Messiah would call others his sibling before the Father. And so what is the author doing in this passage? He's doing the exact same thing. Hundreds of years later, he is saying, because of his suffering, it unlocks a pathway so that we could come to glory. And it tells you his heart from a psalm where it says exactly that reality. Now, the second two quotes, the second and third quotes come from Isaiah chapter 8, verses 17 through 18. And now, this is prophetic language from Isaiah that came through from God through Isaiah to the people during the midst of the Assyrian oppression of the Israelites. And again, I will put my trust in him. And again, behold, I and the children God has given me. Now, when you read it like that, it seems a little bit disjointed, but these are actually meant to be read together. I will put my trust in him, and behold, I and the children God has given me. In other words, Jesus, the Messiah in this, is saying, I put my trust in you, God. But not only me, but also your fellow children that are with me, that you have given me. They're going to put their trust in you as well. In the midst of suffering circumstances, what Isaiah is prophesying about Messiah is that he is not going to only place his trust in the Father, but he is going to invite others through his suffering so that his siblings could also now express that same type of trust in God. Jesus is not ashamed of us because of what he has done. It's not Jesus is not ashamed of us because you're perfect just the way you are. That's not the gospel. The gospel is that Jesus is not ashamed of us because of what he has already done for us. That Jesus is not ashamed of you because of what he has done for you. And that, I promise, that's a lot more freeing than the alternative. Because if any of it was dependent on you, then on your worst days, you might get a weird glance from Brother Jesus over there. But that's not what he does. It is because of what he has done for you. On your best days and on your worst days, he's like, you're mine and I'm yours. Because the King of the cosmos would descend into our humanity. We could be drawn back into the same source. Your perfection or lack thereof is not the focal point of your own story. Your worthiness is an irrelevancy in light of the blood that was paid by Jesus for you. And so, if we understand the level of our brokenness, if we understood it, we would be tempted to run and hide from God. Knowing that if he saw our fallen human condition, we might look up and risk seeing a face of judgment, a face of disgust, disdain, smugness. But our vision of God rarely reflects what we discover in the scriptures. See, Jesus is the image of the invisible God. And if he looks at us without shame, and he's always willing to say, yeah, that's my kid brother. That's my kid sister there with me. Then we will understand the heart of God is one that is filled with love and with arms wide open, not contingent on you, but inviting you in to deeper and wider experiences of his love. Now, we've covered a lot tonight, but I want us to close our time in this part of our gathering with a meditation back on the story of the two brothers. What I want you to do is I'm gonna ask for us to go ahead and start playing some music. And what I want you to do is just get yourself into a comfortable position. If there's room to lay down on your row, feel free to. If you just wanna kind of loosen up your arms and your back just a little bit. And what I want to invite you to do is just get your hands in, if you would desire to, and put them on your lap, just with arms wide open, hands wide open. And I want you to go ahead and just start taking a few deep breaths. What I want you to do as I read over this story is to put yourself in the position of the younger father, the younger son. I want you to think about yourself in terms of the younger son. I want you to think about yourself experiencing what he experienced, feeling how he felt. And then I want you to look to the Father in your mind's eye and envision his response for you. This comes from the Voice translation. Once there was this man who had two sons. One day the younger son came to his father and he said, "Father, eventually I'm going to inherit my share of your estate. Rather than waiting until you die, I want you to give me my share now." And so the father liquidated assets and divided them. Go ahead and take a deep breath in with me. And out. Now a few days passed. And this younger son gathered all of his wealth and he set off on a journey to a distant land. Once there, he wasted everything he owned on wild living. He was broke. A terrible famine struck the land. And he felt desperately hungry and in need. Now he got a job with one of the locals who sent him into the fields to feed the sheep, the pigs. The young man felt so miserably hungry that he wished he could eat the slop the pigs were eating. Nobody gave him anything. Go ahead and take a deep breath in. And out. And another deep breath in. And back out. So he had this moment of self-reflection. What am I doing here? Back home, my father's hired servants have plenty of food. Why am I here starving to death? I'll go up, I'll return to my father, and I'll say, "Father, I have done wrong. Wrong against God. And against you. I have forfeited any right to be treated like your son, but I'm wondering if you'd treat me as one of your hired servants." So he got up and returned to his father. The father looked off in the distance. Take a deep breath in. This is our moment of truth. What's the Father's response to us? Have we messed up too badly? Have we broken things too far? The Father looked off in the distance and saw the young man returning. He felt compassion for his son. And he ran out to him and folded him in an embrace and kissed him. Take a deep breath in and out. What is this response? So the son said, "Father, I have done a terrible thing in God's sight, and in your sight too. I have forfeited any right to be treated as your son." Take a deep breath in and out. We've said our piece. It's all up to Dad now. Can we come back? But the father turned to his servants and said, quick, bring the best robe we have and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and shoes on his feet. Go get the fattest calf and butcher it. Let's have a feast and celebrate because my son was dead. He's alive. He was lost and he's found. And so they have this huge party. Deep breath in. Having a sense of what it means to be an heir of glory. Now the man's older son, though, was still out in the fields working. He came home at the end of the day and he heard music and dancing. And he called one of the servants and he asked what was going on. And the servant said, your brother has returned and your father has butchered the fattest calf to celebrate his safe return. The older brother got really angry and he refused to come inside. So his father came out and pleaded with him to join the celebration. But he argued back, listen, all these years I've worked hard for you. I've never disobeyed one of your orders. But how many times have you ever given me a little goat to roast for a party with my friends? Not once. This isn't fair. So this son of yours comes, this wasteful delinquent who has spent your hard-earned wealth on loose women. What do? You butcher the fattest calf from your herd. And the father replies, is he angry with the older brother? Is he now ashamed of him? Just says, my son, you are always with me and all I have is yours. Isn't it right to join in the celebration and be happy? This is your brother we're talking about. He was dead and he's alive again. He was lost and he is found again. Take a deep breath in and out. I want you to take a moment before God. Imagine the face of the Father in this story. His delight, his deep desire to reconcile these siblings, his deep desire for them to live in freedom, not in bondage, in humility, not in pride, in love, not in disgust. I want to invite the band to come forward. And I would invite you to pray with me. Pray this out loud. Pray this in your heart. My Father, your name is holy. Your kingdom come, your will be done here, now, as it is in your kingdom. Father, I need you. We need you. And we need to experience closeness with you. Yes, Father, I pray for my brothers and sisters here tonight that we would draw near to you, that we would abide in you, not because of our value, but because of you being of infinite value and yet drawing us near to yourself. Self has experienced that love tonight, tomorrow, in the days and years ahead. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.